Thanks very much for the kind words, Sam, though you did sort of make it sound like I can't keep a job. You know, looking at the crowd, I'm reminded that Kissinger was asked, after he worked in the White House, what was the difference having worked in a White House and been a professor? And he said, now when I bore people, they think it's their fault. So I would say that too. When I asked Sam what I should speak about tonight, he said, about 10 minutes. These are wise words. The Ten Commandments fit on two tablets. The Gettysburg Address is 271 words. I'll try to equal them in brevity, if not eloquence. I was 6 years old when the Philadelphia Society was founded. But now I've reached the age, and my white hair confirms it, where I can say I was attending Philadelphia Society meetings before some in this room were born. This was back in the 1980s. Though the issues were different, the Soviet Union was perhaps the dominant concern for most of us then, the need for an organization dedicated to the intellectual foundations of a free society remains as essential today as it was back then. Today we're told that the issues conservatives face are unprecedented and thus must be our answers. Certainly the election of Donald Trump has altered the debate. Much of it is given over to the clash between so-called globalists and so-called nationalists. I'm not persuaded this is really new. And if it is, I remain equally unpersuaded that the answer is a new set of principles. If conservative means anything, surely it means adapting timeless truths about man to new challenges and new circumstances. Those who remember National Review's founding remember some of these same disputes, broadly between freedom and virtue. Bill Buckley's contribution was to champion something that later became called fusionism. Fusionism married traditional virtues of family and faith with anti-communism and free markets. Or in crude terms, he brought together libertarians, social conservatives, and anti-communists in a marriage of convenience. Again, I'm not so sure. I believe that each group on its own may have had an incomplete version of conservatism. What Bill Buckley brought together was a distinctly American conservatism. On the one hand, because of its economic liberalism, it avoided the losing dirigisme of the European conservatisms. On the other, because of the understanding that only a moral citizenry is capable of self-government, it also avoided both what Tocqueville called the soft despotism of government dependency and the anti-religious zealotry of much of continental liberalism. Sometimes one hears social conservatives ask whether an atheist can be a champion of freedom or as steadfast an American citizen as his church-going neighbor. Manifestly, we have the answer to that. Of course he can. Many years ago, while interviewing Sidney Hook, he laughed when I noted that in his biography, for a being whom he posited did not exist, the Almighty made an extraordinary, one is tempted to say miraculous, number of appearances. Milton Friedman was another of the many noble, freedom-loving unbelievers. So the idea that individual non-believers have no home in a conservative America is, I believe, absurd. But I confess I have a larger and more fundamental question. It is this: can human freedom and free markets be sustained in a society that is officially agnostic about fundamental truths about the human person and about our ability to reason our way toward them? This question seems to me at the heart of the growing clashes between the defenders of the liberal order and some of the more traditional folks who now question it. At least some of those who defend the liberal order are skeptical of the idea that there is truth, that it is knowable through reason, and that it guides human action. Put more mildly, they might say that while they do not deny the idea of truth, in a society as diverse as ours, it is either impossible to discern or achieve any consensus about it, so it must remain private. So when someone says America must be rooted in truth, what some of these people hear is someone saying, I'm going to force my understanding of truth on the rest of you, which is pretty much what Milton Friedman expressed in his comment on John Paul's encyclical Centesimus Annus, his most pro-market encyclical. Though Friedman found plenty to commend in the encyclical, he also said that John Paul's line that, quote, obedience to the truth about God and man is the first condition of freedom, end quote, sent shivers down his spine. Whose truth, Friedman asked. To him, it contained echoes of the Spanish Inquisition. Implicit here is a soft relativism. Some are okay with this, seeing it as protection from the zealots who over history have done so much harm while trying to impose their God on others. Ironically, conservative critics of the liberal order often agree that moral relativism is a fundamental requirement, which is why they reject the liberal order. I'm not sure either side has it wholly right. Speaking only for yours truly, I count myself a conventional classical liberal. But the conventional liberalism from which I drink owes less to the French Enlightenment than the Anglo-American one. And it strikes me that one reason we may be seeing sharper disagreement today is that in the US, the secular model has been moving away from the Anglo-American Enlightenment to the more noxious French one. Certainly, whatever else the American founding was, it was not agnostic about truth. The signers of the Declaration rooted our liberty in a creator, declared truths that they laid out to be self-evident, and the rights they imply unalienable. It was not imposed by any religious authority on the young nation. This was the moral consensus of the authors. In this vein, I sometimes wish you that people invoking truth would also make it clear they are not inviting a religious authority to impose it. A more productive way to put it might be to argue that if the rights and freedoms we enjoy are not rooted in transcendent truths about the human person, they will not survive. Just one instance. If there is no God and no truth, how exactly are rights unalienable? Whatever else they were, the founders were not relativists. The Declaration rests on what they called truth that was self-evident. Let me be clear about this. I am also an Orthodox Catholic. As Attorney General Bill Barr found out this week after he gave a speech at Notre Dame, for a Catholic today to say that secularism cannot replace the role of churches in fitting citizens for freedom is treated as a return to the days of crown and faith. There may be some who long for this, and even if they do not regard it as possible. But the vast majority of church-going American Catholics would be the last people on earth to believe America would be better off in a country where our priests and bishops held temporal power, or they were in any way in a position to enforce what they preach. Now, one reason Catholics tend to be most prominent among those accused of hankering for the good old medieval days is that the Catholic Church has been and remains the primary public defender of natural law, i.e., the idea that not all truth comes from the Bible, but that we can discover via reason what human nature requires of us. Natural law explains what should be a contradiction, why the documents of the American founding, written by men who are almost uniformly hostile to the Catholic Church, nonetheless resonate so strongly with Catholics. In our society, a healthy moral culture cannot be imposed, least of all by government. It must be built by persuading our fellow citizens. This is where I part company with some of my fellow social conservatives. Today we hear a great deal about the need for a conservative politics where we have to be willing, much more willing, to use government for interventions that favor our values and beliefs. Whatever else this may be, and whether or not it is practical, the idea of elevating politics over culture on behalf of culture is alien to the mainstream tradition of American conservatism. To begin with, a proper conservatism ought to be skeptical about how effective interventions can be. In the past, many of the interventions we were told would help the working poor, minimum wage, for example, in fact have had the opposite effect. Aid to families with dependent children helped contribute to the destruction of the black family. The federal student loans for college has now left young Americans with debt they cannot pay off, and a degree that often means nothing. The pronatalist policies that are now the vogue have been tried in nations from France to Singapore with little to show for it. Surely the burden of proof is on those pushing these prescriptions to demonstrate, against much evidence to the contrary, why their proposals would work, where so many similar proposals just like theirs have failed. That's the practical objection. I have a philosophical one too. How can we ever suppose that politicians will be willing and capable of articulating and defending moral positions that no one hears articulated or defended from the pulpits? The job of the culture is to inform the politics. It is a lot of freight to put on politician to expect him to carry the entire load by himself. One more point. Trade has become a big bugaboo among some conservatives. At bottom, trade is the ability to buy or sell goods or services from others, regardless of borders. If you can get a Toyota cheaper than a Ford, why should someone stop that? If you can get someone to build your Fords more cheaply, why should someone stop that? And if you do stop that, presumably in order to defend the local producers, why not go further? Why not stop the people in a town from buying their appliances at Target or Best Buy and instead force them to buy from the more expensive shop in their city centers? Where does it end? Where does this leave me? Often it leaves me frustrated. I admire my friend at Notre Dame, Pat Dineen, and I share many of his moral concerns about where America's headed, particularly with the growing animus toward religion. But when I read his solutions, as well as his assertions about how capitalism works, for example, the idea that global markets are devastating the environment, it doesn't ring true to me. And as much as I would love having Pat for a neighbor, I don't think the answer is more composting and for me to buy his vegetables and for him to buy my beef. My friends, I am not in the middle. I believe social conservatives are correct in their views of transcendent truth and the price societies pay for disregarding it. But I also believe that economic growth is not merely an abstract statistic. It is what allows, more than anything else, ordinary Americans to realize their dreams, college for their kids, a home of their own, a new car now and then, and move ahead in society. It allows us to sustain independent, functioning institutions from the Philadelphia Society to our local churches. When we limit the market, we hurt the people we pretend we are helping. If I had to sum up my answer, social conservatives need to have more appreciation for how markets actually work, how they often serve conservative ends. For example, by allowing families to have the wherewithal to provide for themselves, and not least how the best of intentions behind government interventions can often have catastrophic human consequences. Not to mention a hard calculation about the prospects for victory in a culture war in an America where the conservative view can no longer be assumed to be the majority view. Libertarians, by contrast, might do well to ask whether they really mean to imply that libertarianism requires relativism about truth and morality. We know in practice it doesn't. Libertarians such as Justin Amash, just to name one, are ardent Christians and pro-life. At the very least, libertarians ought to ask if the liberty they desire can be sustained in a society where more and more people are dependent on government, where family life is attenuated, and our public square is naked. Libertarians are in principle opposed to many of the statist programs that encourage dependency, from welfare to food stamps. But is it really a coincidence that as the influence of religion wanes, more and more Americans find themselves looking to the state for help? I will leave it here. I leave it here because tomorrow you have a whole day of debating these issues in much greater detail to make up your own mind. My hope tonight was not to provide the answers, but suggest maybe one direction of some of the questions. In the next day, you will argue and disagree, sometimes vehemently. That, too, is part of the proud heritage of the free society and part of the heritage of the Philadelphia Society. So I thank you for coming. I thank you for listening. And I hope you all enjoy the challenges and debate tomorrow will bring.